Would you please help me welcome our speaker up to the podium? He's Dwight from Amherst, and his home group is the Amherst Young Peoples.
Thank you. Is that bad?
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Dwight. I am an alcoholic. And I guess that's why I'm here. And maybe it's why you're here. Give me a few minutes to get going. My home group is the Amherst Young Peoples, even though I have a lot of gray hairs and a grandson. I'm just a baby. And with your help, I'm growing up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think I had the epiphany or revelation or one of the two on the way down here with my traveling buddy that I may never grow up. I'm almost to 60, and I'm still a kid. I used to be a genius, and then I got sober, and I realized that I don't know anything. I call myself an idiot, but that's just self-depraving, and it's really not the truth. Knucklehead may be a better term. Thanks for the water. I'm going to take some. My sobriety date, October 17, 2010. I would like to tell you that back sometime in the mid-80s when the proverbial shit the fan, I had the mandate from my then wife that I needed to stop drinking. But that's not my sober date, because I wasn't willing to listen to you folks, because you needed this thing called higher power. And you called it God, and I left. And I only came back a couple times, mostly with friends of mine that were Alcoholic Anonymous members. And most of them had relapsed with me, and they were on their way back to tell you all that they had relapsed and to get that cheap little 24-hour chip. And since I was still with them and they were trying to carry the message to me, they brought me with them. And I heard the same thing and realized why I wasn't here. Now I realize what it was that kept me from here was my disease kept me from coming back. My disease had nothing to do with alcohol. My disease had nothing to do with drugs and anything else that I would use to try and fix this problem that's right here. Right here with me. It goes everywhere I go. And it brought me to my knees many times. But that wasn't enough to bring me here because, as I told you before, I was a genius, and I didn't need this, and I could figure my way out of this. And what I did was I turned to other people. I always turned to people that I thought were doing something that was attractive. And I owned a business in the mid-80s, and I had these guys working for me. And they were like, dude, you got to lighten up, man. And, I'm like, I'll try. And they're like, man, you're a mess.
why don't you just like, why don't you just go home and like smoke a couple of doobers and have a 40 like we do and just stay home and chill out. You know, why do you have to go be crazy and disappear for days? And I said, I don't know. And, I ended up trying their solution. And it didn't work for me. I mean, here's what happened. You know, it worked for a day or two. In a day or two, I'd run out of the purchase that I'd made for the whole week. And I was going crazy. And I needed a drink. That's what this genius thing here was telling me. I needed a drink. And that's what the people that knew me, like my wife, said, you know, just go get a drink. Because I was crazy and really nuts without a drink. And I was crazy and really nuts with a drink. So people couldn't stand me either way. But it took me about 7 years to actually successfully wean myself off. Did I say 7 years? About 7 years to successfully wean myself off of binge drinking. In respect to AA, I have some other non-AA approved substances in my story, and they're a big part of my story, a big part of who I am. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm addicted to anything that I think is going to help me out, anything that I think is going to give me some kind of relief, because that's what I need. I need relief. I need something that makes me feel okay. I think the big book calls it ease and comfort. I just want to be comfortable, man. I really don't need or want a lot unless, you know, I mean, I might tell you that, especially if I know you're holding a lot. I'll tell you that I need a lot. But the bottom line is that, you know, I just need to be okay. In October of 2010, I met this man that I had met. Well, I'd met him almost a year before, and we were introduced. And I was told that I should ask this guy to sponsor me. And I said, "Oh, okay, yeah." And I took his number and I shook his hand and you know, I had that smile on my face, and I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, I'll give you a call, man. We will talk," you know. And there was this other conversation going on inside my head that I didn't have any control over, and it was like, "Yeah, right," you know. And I never called this guy. As a matter of fact, I was kind of afraid of him because it seemed to me that he was like way too comfortable. And if he was sober, that was downright scary to me, that he was sober and he was comfortable. Like, I can't compute that. This genius up here cannot fathom that you can be comfortable without some kind of substance. You know, it's like, all right, you can tell me what it is. And so I was scared, you know, looking back at it, I was scared. Then I was just too smart. So in 2010, at October afternoon, I sat down at the picnic table with this guy, and I was going to ask him to be my sponsor, but that turned out to be a more difficult task than I thought it was. When I was prodded, you know, like, "Hey, go ask Steve to sponsor you." And so I was like, "So do you have a minute? I got a couple questions for you." So we sat down at the picnic table. And wouldn't you know, this activity up here just wouldn't let me get a word in. It just was crazy, and it was like really fast, and I couldn't grab a sentence or a question or anything conceivably rational out of what was going on in my head. And I sat there, and I don't know what I looked like, except that I work now with new guys, and I've seen it in their eyes, and it's fear. And that was me. And Steve calmly said to me, "Dwight, what do you want most out of life?" Wow, my brain just went to triple overdrive. Like, it was like, I'm never going to be able to, like, come up with an answer to that question, let alone the question that I was going to ask him in the first place. And so right about when I was ready to burst into tears and just, like, weep uncontrollably, I looked into his eyes, and he was sitting there waiting for my answer, calmly. And for a moment, I had this, like, peace came over me. It was almost as though he was like Yoda, and he just, like, willed this peace onto me. Just like... And I was like, all I want is, like, love. All I want is to be okay. That's it. He goes, he shook his head and he smiled. And suddenly, for some reason, without any more words than that, I had this sense that maybe I could be okay. And maybe if I could stick with this guy, maybe I could have that he had that seemed so unattainable. And I did. And the question that I asked him wasn't, will you be my sponsor? I really don't remember exactly what it was. I think that he just put two and two together and, you know, said, follow me. And I started a journey. A journey that, you know, I started and I realized, you know, I've come full circle. So I'll go back to the beginning. I grew up in a God-loving family that had a spiritual solution in their lives. I was born into a family where mom and dad gave unconditional love to all six of us kids. Mom and dad started a Baptist church. Mom and dad gave freely of their time and laid their life down on a daily basis for neighbors, friends, people in need, families in need. Something that I swore I would never do. It was very unattractive to me because, you know, I got me to worry about, you know, and that's a problem. You know, that's a big thing. And I couldn't see, you know, spending my time to, like, help you. I mean, unless you had something that I wanted, you know, then, yeah, I'll bend over backwards, man. I'll, like, show up for it every day. But to just have unconditional love and just to lay my life down for my brother or my sister without expecting anything in return, well, that was just preposterous. And to this genius brain, it didn't make any sense at all. And so growing up in this family of love, I was miserable. And I remained miserable, even though in the church, you know, I memorized chapters out of the Bible. You know, I was head of the youth group, you know, mostly because of who my parents were, you know. I don't really know what people actually thought of me. I think that they were very patient, forgiving, understanding people. But at any rate, I was a mess. And I pretended to not be. I pretended to be a genius. I pretended to walk among you as one of you, perhaps even better than you. You know, you just had to find out from me. And I lived my life that way, and I didn't realize any of it until I found that man that was willing to lay his life down for me in 2010. I didn't realize any of it until I started writing a fourth step. And I was going back over my life. And then I sat down with this man and I told him about my life. And I started to learn about what I am and what I'm made of. And the fact that I have one giant flaw. And it's holding me back from experiencing love and pure joy in my life that I don't need a drink to feel okay with. You know, and that one thing that's holding me back is that I obsess about me. What I need, what I might not get, what I might lose, what you're thinking of me. You know, like, drove me crazy on a daily, on a minute-to-minute basis sometimes, especially standing in front of a crowd that, you know, I'm not reciting something or doing something that you're here to watch and that I could be applauded for or something. You know, I'm here to share the truth about me, which really, in my mind, is not all that pretty, except that I found something. You know, and I feel like that's why I'm here, is to share what I found. But to continue on of what I am and what I was, I was scared. And yet when it came to writing my fourth step, I said, Steve, you know, it says resentments on one page, fears on another, and sex conduct and harms on another. I really don't have any fears to speak of. Steve has this ultimate patience, and he's like, fine, just write the other ones. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to get along with this guy. And when I was going through my resentments was when I realized that I am full of fear. I am driven by fear. I am ruled by fear. Self-obsessed, ruled by fear. And all I want out of love, out of this world, is love. All I want is to feel love right here. I want to feel loved, and I want to feel giving love. I just want like this kind of happiness, and I believe that it's love. I believe that this thing that I call God is love. It's a spirit. It's a thing that I can't see, but I can see the evidence of it. You know, I can't define it, but I can't deny it, you know. And so I lived on my life obsessed with me, driven by fear, in a family full of love and service to others. All the time, all I wanted to do was to get away from those people because I can't comprehend giving myself to anyone else or for the service of anyone else. I just can't comprehend it unless there's something in it for me. And so I did. And so I left home at 17. I picked up a drink a couple of years before that. And that kind of helped precipitate my leaving, because as soon as I picked up a drink, I realized that I had something. I realized that I was completely afraid of women, especially women that I was attracted to, and that with a little old granddad, well, that changed everything. And so at the Drobny's party, I had some old granddad in Marty's bedroom with him, and my first swig, I couldn't even hold down. I spit basically spewed it all over the place, but fought with him to get it back. And I kept swigging off it until I could hold it down and until that warm, burning feeling, until I could feel that. And it was like I turned into Superman. And I went right out and asked Leanne to dance. And she said, yeah. And we started dancing. And right as I asked her to dance, it went from, you know, Led Zeppelin to George Harrison, Here Comes the Sun. And so I got the slow dance. And I was like, wow, I love this. And so I brought Leanne close to me, and we danced. And man, I was in heaven. I had that burning old granddad, and I had this beautiful woman with her cashmere sweater, and life just couldn't get any better than that. And then up it came, and that ruined her sweater, and she never spoke to me again. And you know, I had a very rough time of it in those days until I was able to imbibe enough and build up a tolerance so that I could drink a little more without losing it on a cashmere sweater. But I was a mess. I was a mess until I could find something that gave me a little bit of happiness. Even if it was a little bit, it seemed like a world, you know, like a little thing, like dancing with the girl. There was plenty in a, you know, the high school dance, it was like the whole dance floor was full of people, especially for the slow songs in my high school, you know. But for me, I couldn't do it unless I was shit-faced. And then, of course, once I was feeling okay and feeling good enough to do it, you didn't want to have anything to do with me, you know, especially because you heard about what happened to Leanne. So, you know, like, if he's got booze on his breath, man, just stay away from him. You know, he's no good. And that was me. And I couldn't stop. And, you know, I could go on and on with stories about that. But at the time, I didn't realize that was a problem. You know, I didn't realize that when I met Sermon at UConn, that she was from Turkey and basically could not go out with me until her parents met me. And I was working at Chuck's Steakhouse, and I said, well, have them come up to Chuck's and we'll go to dinner, because I got employee prices, you know, and I was head cook there at 18, and it would be great. Well, I couldn't stop obsessing about the fact that she was going to come with her mom and dad, and, you know, we're going to have dinner, and then I get to go out with her. And, well, back in those days, we got 50-cent drinks from the bar, and the bar had Dewars on the well. And so I could get 50-cent Dewars on the rocks. And let me tell you, you know, Dewars, I went through a lot of pain to like Dewars, because this man that I was impressed with and wanted to be like was a fall-down drunk, and he drank Dewars. He was an engineer. He had a pilot's license, and he owned a pump company, and he paid me big bucks to drive and to go work on pump orders that he screwed up because he was such a drunk. And so I thought it was somebody. And he was just really, really awesome. And I don't know what it was that impressed me so about this guy, especially when I would find him in his office on the floor and I would look for that bottle. And before he came to, before I would wake him up, I would drink that bottle. Usually it was only the amount that could stay in the bottle because it would be laying on the floor with the cap off. But I would drink it, and then I would wake him up. And to this day, I don't know why. Well, at the time, I didn't know why. Now I do. Now I do is because I know that there's something wrong with the way I think. And it's not that I think I'm a genius. It's that I think all kinds of crazy thoughts like that I'm a genius. And that I'm better than you, and I'm nuts, and my parents knew it, you know, and they brought me to a lot of shrinks, and I was diagnosed with all kinds of, you know, things, and I'm here to tell you that, you know, alcohol can enhance some of these things, like schizophrenia, I made the mistake of telling the shrink that I thought I was Jesus Christ. And I said, well, I'm never going to do that again because, you know, he came up with all these notes on the piece of paper and handed it to my parents. And there was a big turmoil about that. And I was like, geez, man, everybody's so uptight, you know. And but, yeah, I have a problem with my head. Okay, I'm insane. All right, I'm insane. And what I think cures me, because shouldn't I know best what's best for me, is a drink. And even though it produced all kinds of crazy things, when Sermon's parents got to the bar where I was waiting for them, and they were waiting, we were waiting for our table. Well, I had a few of those 50-cent doers. And by the time they got there, they noticed that I was slurring my speech. And so it took them about as long as it took to order when the cocktail waitress came up and they ordered tea and soda. And before the drinks got there, they got up and shielded their daughter from me and escorted her out, and I never saw her again because I was a horrific sight. And I don't know what I said, but it probably wasn't appropriate. And, you know, I don't know what their experience was, but I know I felt just fine. I felt just fine. And I don't know what their problem was, but they had to leave. And this kind of story was with me my whole life. And I was constantly trying to manipulate it, to adjust it, what I'm drinking. You know, I ended up with 100 proof vodka as my drink of choice. Because my brain told me that you wouldn't smell it as much. And I know now that that's just not true. But I knew that when I drank scotch, that people from across the room knew that I was drinking. As I opened the door to my car, which I drove, they knew that I was drinking. In the days that I was drinking, they wouldn't arrest me for DUI. You know, they would slap me around, they would beat me up, and they would ask me if I could drive home. And of course, I always gave them that answer, like, yeah. You know, so I ended up, I had one DUI, and that wasn't even the end of it. I ended up managing a restaurant in Florida at 22, and I found some substances down there that enhanced my drinking, and I kind of went with that, only realized that that the more I did of that, the more I needed, and it turned into a really vicious cycle, and I ended up doing things with me that I never, ever, 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 ever thought I would do. Things that I've had to since share with another man, and since I and things that I have since shared with guys that I reach my hand out to, things that that I thought I would never ever share with anyone that I was going to take to the grave with me, things that crumbled me inside. And when I would have that first drink, I would be so crumbled that I could not stop. I could not stop until I was stopped, until something else stopped me. And it wasn't until the day, well, here's how it happened. I was driving with my sponsor, and we had done three steps and said a third step prayer, and he said you have to immediately start upon an inventory because there are things blocking you from that sunlight of God. And if you're going to give yourself to God to do God's will and to be a reflection of God's light to other people, then you need to get this stuff out of your way. And there's stuff in your way. Otherwise, you would be able to stop and drinking wouldn't be a problem and drugs wouldn't be a problem and you wouldn't be here. There's things in your way and you need to get, and you need to deal with it. And so right away, there's things in my head and I'm already putting up those, like, all right, how am I going to deal with this? Because there's a few things that are not going anywhere near this like list. And, I don't know if my thinking is like really loud, but the next thing my sponsor said to me was, he goes, well, you know, he goes, well, there's actually three things that you can take to the grave with you. Three things that you never have to tell anybody. And I was like, whew! I got relief right away. I was like, whoa, man, three things. And I had three things right there in the front of my head. And he kept chuckling and chuckling. And I'm like, you know, like looking around like, can he read my mind? Does he know what they are? And he's laughing at me. And later on he said, you know those three things? And I'm like, what? He goes, you can take those to the grave with you, but they're going to kill you. And I about lost it. I about lost it because you know what? These things were so disgusting to me that I couldn't bear telling you because you know why? Because I've got to make you guys think that I'm a genius. I got to make you guys think that I'm cool, you know, that I'm the shit. And if I tell you this, you're going to be like, wow, dude, you're a mess. And he said, those three things that are dancing in your head right now are the things that are going to kill you. And you know what? I was ready. I was ready. Because what I did was I went home and I put those three things right at the top of my list, man. And they were on my sex conduct list, yeah. And I put them right at the top of my list. And you know what? When I wrote them down, I can almost feel that relief now. And that was almost 5 years ago. I started getting relief then. And I hear people from the podium saying all the time when they share it with their sponsor, you know, that's when they get that relief. Man, when I wrote that down, because you know what? That had never, those things had never seen the light of day Those things were only known by people that I did them with and God. That was it. When I wrote it down, I knew the gig was up. And when I wrote them down, I was like, wow. And I had the voice of my sponsor in my head, you know, like, Dwight, if they're in the dictionary, you're not the only one that's done them. And probably someone else did them better. And, you know, when I wrote those things down, man, it was like I was emptied of that. And I started getting relief, and that sunlight started to shine on me, you know. And I'm so thankful that my sponsor saved me the time of doing a fifth step with him and having it not work, because I had those things in my back pocket and I ain't bringing them out for anybody. Instead, somehow he had that little trick. And you know what? That's a little trick that I've learned. I tell guys I'm working with that story. But you know what else I do? I share one of those three things with them. And sure, a lot of the guys I sponsor say, wow, mine aren't that bad. You know? And you know what? That makes my heart feel really good. You know, not because I think I'm a scumbag, but because I know I'm doing the right thing now. You know, I got rid of that. I don't feel like I'm less than you now, and I have to boast and brag and act like I'm better than you just because I feel less than. You know, I'm happy for that, because by sharing that with another guy, he feels at home sharing that thing that's deep and down deep in his heart, that he doesn't want to share because it sounds just as bad as what I had sounded to me, you know, until I get it out and I realize that, you know, we're just humans. I just suffer from this desire to be okay. I just suffer from this desire to be comfortable. Is that so bad? I just want to be comfortable. You know, my sponsor says, he doesn't even believe it's a disease. He says, you know, I ruffle a lot of feathers in AA, but you know, he calls us relief seekers. You know, we are expert relief seekers. We will search and find anything. And when I was 10 years old, man, I was obsessed with candy. I almost died because of this candy called Sugar Daddies. You ever hear of those things? They're little round things. They come in a bag like M&Ms, you know. And when I would get money at camp to go to the snack bar to get stuff, I would go in and buy 3 or 4 bags of them. And I'd go out behind the commissary, and I'd try to wolf down, like, you know, 2 or 3 of the bags so that I would just have one look normal coming back. And this was me choking on Sugar Daddies out behind the candy shack, choking. I couldn't breathe. And somebody saw me, and they came out there and, you know, gave me the Heimlich and helped me out. And I lived, you know. Sugar babies. You know, that's pathetic. But that was me, you know. I did the same thing, you know, and it made me feel good for like 2 minutes. And then I had a raging headache. And you know, I couldn't drink enough water. And I was angry and miserable. And yet I did it over and over and over until I found alcohol. So I had, it's been over 23 years that I've been drunk on alcohol, because those guys that worked for me convinced me that if I had enough marijuana, I wouldn't want to go go to the Packy. And then even if I did go to the Packy, it would take me half as much, a quarter as much, a tenth as much alcohol to get where I wanted to be. And like I said before, it took me 7 years to build up a tolerance enough to smoke enough of that stuff to where I was crippled enough where I wouldn't go to the Packy. And by that drink and that eight ball and disappear for a few days. And I just turned into a waste cadet for my son. Are we running out of time? Is this clock right? 8:50? Well, I mixed in a little of my sober story too. But what really brought me to my knees was almost dying a couple of times. The first time, my son had come off the streets and got recovery. My son that I saw on the streets of Greenfield, Massachusetts, been out running, track marks up and down his arm, dying. That kind of broke me, being a dad and contributing to his alcoholism. And when he was 13 years old, what a great dad. And I prayed to God. I said, God, if you save my son, I will serve you. Because I knew what that was. My parents served God. And I thought that was the most despicable thing in the world and that I would never do it. And so if God would save my son, I'll even do that. And as soon as my son got recovery, I somehow forgot about that until I did a third step. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. Wow, serve God. Oh my. And my son picked me up from the hospital because no one else would. And he brought me to his sober house where he had was working three jobs to rent this big house and bring guys from detox back and do the 12 steps with him because it filled him up. And it gave him what drugs and alcohol could never give him, a solution for free. A solution, a steak instead of a bone. And I said, well, that's great. That's good. And I had 6 days sobriety when he picked me up from the hospital, and it lasted another 6 days. But then I did what I did, and that was a sober house, so you're not supposed to do that there. So I left, and on my way out, something was said to me, and I'll put him on blast. It was my son, and he said, Dad, you may suffer from a spiritual malady like I do. Oh, I had never hit that kid, but man, I wanted to right then and there. How dare you say that to me? I was brought up in a family, you know, like I thought maybe it came rubbed off on me, osmosis, you know, because my mom and dad were so spiritual and my brothers and sisters are so spiritual. And that bugged me for the next 10 months. I could not get that out of my head. And I saw my life unfold in front of me. Not just was my drug use unmanageable, my life was unmanageable. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't do anything straight. I couldn't live normally. And I had this little awareness where I'm looking at other people, you know, and I'm looking at them and I'm judging you. And I'm thinking to myself, well, they seem okay. How come I want to die? And oh, wanting to kill yourself is not like a good way to live. That's psych ward stuff, man. And that was me. I didn't want to live. When I ran out of what I was using to feel okay, I wanted to die. And when I had it, I felt like I was better than everybody. And suddenly, over those 10 months, I started to see that there's something wrong with that line of thinking. And there's something about what my son was doing that I wanted. I'm like, how come these guys are happy? And I know that kid. You know, he has a drink and he can't stop, just like me. You know, he can't get there, just like me. And now, he's like, something's going on. And I called him up. And I said, you know what? You still got that sober house? And he's like, yeah. Yeah, man, it's great. You going to come by and check us out? And I said, do you have a room? He's like, yeah, Dad. Come on down. That was a Sunday night. And so Monday morning, I got up Monday morning, October 17th, and I didn't do what I had been doing every day. I jumped in my little Toyota truck, and I drove down to Amherst, Massachusetts. And I came there, and I was welcomed with open arms. Bunch of young guys, young heroin addicts and stuff. And they welcomed me with open arms. They were having an experience that was everything that I wanted. They were comfortable. They were laughing. And they were holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. And every time that something like that happened, I would bawl my eyes out. And I didn't know why. But you know what? That was the last time I drank. And that was the last time I used something else to solve the hole in my heart. You know? And this journey has had challenges. But you know what? I haven't had to drink. I've come full circle. I'm doing what my mom and dad do. I'm trying on a daily basis to lay my life down for my brother, for you, for anyone. I don't care if you're sober and miserable or sober and just having a bad day. I don't care if you're high and having a bad day and you want to change. I want to be there for you. You know, just the other morning, a guy named Kevin calls me up and he starts telling me that he wants me to sponsor him, but he really doesn't want AA. And instead of going to AA, he wants to drink rum. But you know what? I answer the phone for him. And I realize that when he is ready, I can be there. All I have to do is answer the phone and show him love and show him what I'm doing. That's it. I don't have to be a genius. I just have to be a knucklehead that has God in my heart, that has love in my heart, and I'm willing to show up for my brothers. You know? And you know what? There's a lot more of us than we know. You look to your right, you look to your left, you look in front of you and back of you, and there's probably someone sitting right there that has that love in their heart, and they're willing to reach their hand out and show up for you, and that's all we can do. And I know I got to stop. I guess I just want to end with this, that you know, my sponsor always said, Dwight, you're a messenger. You're not in the results business. Because I started getting upset about guys I was sponsoring that were going out and relapsing. And he said, I hear the voice of my grand sponsor, Tom, he's with me all the time. And he said, Dwight, you're the paper delivery boy. You throw the paper up on the driveway and you pedal on. If that guy picks up the paper and he goes and starts the fire with it, none of your business. Your business is to get it up there on his doorstep. That's it. He says, if he reads every word, that's his choice. If he burns it up, That's his choice. It's not yours. It's up to God. Just drop that paper off. Just show up. And that's all I did. Thank you, guys. I love you.